You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is 3:30 a.m., Wednesday, November 4th of 2020. I've been following electoral politics in America and throughout the world for just over 30 years, and it really never ceases to bore me. But this election, as I've said many times, is unique in the blatant and clear interference from every power center in America against the Trump candidacy. Shutting down thousands and thousands of Facebook pages, of Twitter accounts. I have been permanently banned from Facebook, unfortunately, just a few days before the election. Constant voter intimidation, threats against Trump supporters, violence exclusively from leftists in the inner cities has reached a point where most Trump supporters won't talk about their support for him outside of small-town America. The Virginia race, I think 200,000 votes for Biden showed up at the last minute because it was going for Trump. You have a candidate that not even Democrats have any enthusiasm for. Then you have Donald Trump, who was selling out massive football stadiums, even in small-town America, over and over again. And Biden had nobody and nothing. He barely campaigned, yet he's supposed to be neck and neck with Donald Trump, as is the case right now. If Donald Trump loses, it is based exclusively on fraud, media manipulation, and corporate threats against and financing mobs against Americans, especially white Americans. If these practices were done in the third world, the U.S. would completely invalidate the election and threaten sanctions in the country. The banning of everything right-wing on YouTube and all social media means that the election is completely fraudulent. You can't claim any kind of free speech in the political realm, which is the only thing it meant, by allowing the forums where this speech is exercised to do what they please. That's somewhat like saying you have full free speech in this country, just so long as you don't do it in English. The fraud is so overwhelming, the media bias so absurd, it really shows you what democracy really is. Now, because so many of us have been banned from all social media, groups banned, communications even, banned from supporters of any right-wing cause, on every social media platform worthy of the name, the regime now believes it's insulated. So now it's absolutely going crazy. Do not believe that when these riots begin in the major cities that there are any Trump supporters present. I know for years Antifa's been dressing up as their opponents. There is no way, I'm telling you right now, there's no way our people are going to go especially in small numbers, and face off Black Lives Matter or Antifa in the streets. They're not going to do that. More than anything else, we saw the massive popularity of Donald Trump on every social media platform, despite the constant banning and censorship, whether it be, you know, Twitter, Twitter numbers or Facebook likes. Donald Trump was 3 and 4 times the number of Biden and Hillary Clinton. So there's no question, however you slice this, the regime has completely invalidated this election, and if Trump actually does pull it off, then that means he won. You know, I don't believe that Joe Biden could get any more than 20%. I think that's fairly, that's a very reasonable thing to say under the circumstances. But I want to talk today, again, about Alexander Dugin's outlook on the geopolitics of American presidential elections, especially in 2020. I've been a longtime supporter and expert in his thinking, having read all of his major and most of his minor works over the years in Russian. But I'm a critic of his, especially when it comes to more practical day-to-day politics, the things that I don't particularly care for, but we have to talk about. And here's an article that came out a few days ago, The Geopolitics of American Elections. And it's worth discussing because it explains really our position to a great extent, although with some exaggerations. And the first thing he says is something we all know. Because of the rise of Donald Trump, means the rise of some form of nationalism. Trump's policies are all over the place in that respect, but at least among mainstream conservatives, it made nationalism somewhat respectable for the first time in a long time. That up until 2016, Democrat and Republican candidates for president were identical. They were all globalists. They were neoliberal. They believed in constant American aggression abroad. They believed in American exceptionalism and all the rest of that. That was the standard view. There was really no distinction between the candidates until 2016. And that was the so-called Washington Consensus, the creation of corporate capital, especially the banks, who control the world that politicians have to function in. The fact that Donald Trump was not a politician speaks volumes about all of it. Now, that establishment over the years sought cooperation and coordination with the USSR, the Council on Foreign Relations, the elite foreign policy think tanks all over the place believed in this kind of convergence, as Dugin would call it. However, this collapsed when the Soviet Union began to collapse. The only reason you have any criticism of the Soviet Union today is that it simply didn't, it wasn't able to last. Once Gorbachev signed a death warrant and brought Yeltsin in, the globalists realized that any kind of convergence with the USSR was now moot and completely irrelevant. So, as most of us know, the 1990s was globally a complete disaster, because the so-called Washington Consensus was violently imposed everywhere. Whether you talk about, you know, George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Clinton or any of these people, globalism was accepted without the slightest deviation. And of course, as we also know, that the neocons ousted any of the isolationist types or nationalist types really throughout the 1980s and rendered them on the margins of American politics, which again, Donald Trump, at least in a certain cultural sense, though not literally, made respectable again. So really what it came down to in American presidential elections was differences that are mostly symbolic, promoted by the press looking for, you know, gaffes and one-liners and issues that could be summarized in a few words that the common man can understand, and really nothing of any great substance. And Dugin concludes, of course, that there is no such thing, up until 2016, as the geopolitics of an American election. It simply was the head of the Hydra. Now, Dugin says that, again, that changed in 2016. Of course, a lot of us were saying that. But Dugin exaggerates. He says, and I quote, "Trump's entire campaign program was built on criticism of globalism and the ruling American elites." In other words, Trump threw down a direct challenge to the bipartisan consensus, including the neoconservative wing of his party, the Republicans, and he won. That is simply not true. Donald Trump, over and over again, has given his general support to the globalist project. It's true that he, believe it or not, hasn't started a war and has drawn down a few wars, which makes him absolutely exceptional. He has followed the exact same line as the presidents before him in terms of foreign policy. Not starting a war doesn't necessarily mean that Donald Trump was in favor of isolationism. It meant that the U.S. simply wasn't winning any of these wars, doesn't have the money, didn't have the men, and the military, physically speaking, was falling apart. And if you go to my Patreon page, which I strongly recommend you do, I have an entire series of papers explaining why the U.S. military is a paper tiger. And it, again, physically falling apart, from the service academies to how they distribute medals. No one else is talking about this but me, as always. But you do have a couple of old-time veterans who will bring this up in a non-systematic way. So he's exaggerating in that sense. Dugin has taken a few isolated lines, the America First kind of stuff, which were not implemented to a great extent, and took that as the entirety. He says his entire campaign program was, but no, it was not. It is true that he actually mentioned the word globalism in a negative light, which was brand new. Rejecting, you know, some of the, at least in rhetorically speaking, some of the free trade dogmas and things like that. But the enemies were still the same. The use of the military, was, although it's drawn down, still he did not reject these interventions, but he blamed others for their failure. And of course, you know, bringing people like John Bolton and Mattis and these other people along with him strongly suggests that, you know, he was a bit out of his depth here. Foreign policy was not his thing, but he was not about to break with the globalist idea. But because he won, and he won despite massive fraud and violence and coercion from the left, despite all that, he still won. He realized that, of course, this program was a winner. But this was mostly rhetoric. And his foreign policy is half-hearted and non-systematic, but he's been harder on Russia than any other president. The fact that the regime knows this and still maintains that somehow Putin has an influence here, without any explanation as to how that might be done, which is, you know, made me laugh from the very beginning, and it just shows you the fraud of electoral and the major media who controls all these processes. But of course they know that he has continued the war on Russia. He's expelled 100 diplomats from this country. He has tripled the sanctions. He's added people to the sanctions list. He has given military aid to Ukraine, and he brags about it. He believes all the myths about, you know, the poisoning of you know, Novichok and all this utter nonsense. He always claimed he was going to take action against the social media people on this respect, and of course never did. But he's been harder on Russia or China than any president in recent memory. Especially the ham-handed use of sanctions, which I've argued elsewhere really aren't real. But that's been it. I mean, he had a rhetorical connection with certain very moderate forms of civic nationalism, and that's it. He hasn't carried that out in any real way. However, even if it's just rhetoric, the use of a phrase like America First was enough to change the foreign policy dynamics. The fact that bringing up the issues that Pat Buchanan brought up in 1992 and many others before him now became mainstream. The regime's intellectuals, never having to answer those arguments before, probably never even heard them before, simply used censorship and force and threats to answer these arguments, which, you know, they knew nothing about. Corporate America declared war on Trump, and I believe, if I remember correctly, it was Sears, thank God it's gone now, who was the very first corporation to attempt to destroy him. And corporate America, before anyone really knew what his agenda was, corporate America had already declared war on him on the grounds that he wanted a moderate reduction in illegal immigration. As it turns out, Obama deported more than Trump has. It's only because of the media rhetoric saying that Trump is this horrible guy where you see a bit of a diminution in immigration. Of course, the problem is legal immigration, not illegal immigration. The United States will be perfectly fine without a single immigrant ever admitted ever again. And that's your classic neocon Republican idea. But Dugin makes the argument that even if it's just rhetoric, he's changed the relationship. He doesn't mention that Republicans as a party are repudiated Donald Trump. The main line, although, you know, they realize that these are winning issues, we're not behind him on a lot of these things, although a handful were. But you did have the slight, very moderate resurrection of the America First idea, whatever that might mean. But especially since there really is no, you know, there's no unified America, there never has been. But corporate America then went into action. All corporations have at least one large tax-exempt foundation with which they finance liberal parties, liberal movements. They've been doing this for decades. George Soros often is the face of this, but he's one of many. Not even the most major one. Goldman Sachs is more important than he is. He's just kind of the face on it. Unless people have are able to personify something, they don't understand it. And so he allowed himself to do that. But to claim that this is just him is laughable. All of corporate America supports the left. Capitalism is a revolutionary ideology, and it's always been. But even if it's just rhetoric, even if it's just Trump talking about limiting immigration, building a wall, which is some more symbolic than real, and throwing tariffs on certain goods, and even talking about possibly illegal immigration reductions, that was sufficient for corporate America to begin financing extreme left movements. Extreme left meaning anarchists and communists. And as you all know, the declaration of war on Donald Trump from the regime confirms everything that I've been saying for 25 years. The gloves were off, and so they didn't have to pretend to be journalists anymore. So the issues go like this. The system has been destabilized, at least the press is talking. This has been going on for a long time. The press is just covering it with greater aplomb. Financing anarchist and leftist groups. We know that corporate America has supported them now. It's very clear. Direct demonization and censorship is the order of the day. Throwing around these words that they don't know the meaning of, like fascism and white supremacism. None of these are ever defined or understood. They're simple. It's nothing more than rhetoric. And even claiming that he is the tool of foreign powers, this has destroyed what little consensus was left. If you go back to presidential debates, let's say prior to 1980, a lot of the ideological issues didn't exist. There was a great consensus among Americans, and questions really were over technical details. I've mentioned before my favorite American election, the election of 1960, clearly stolen from Nixon, which he understood, but he conceded anyway. Those two debates were at an extreme high level, and I recommend you listen to them and compare them to the garbage that's being said now. One of Trump's big errors is to talk about China actually coming to America and stealing jobs. Now, he's got to know that this isn't true. The Chinese didn't send soldiers and dismantle American manufacturing and send it to China and rebuild it there. But that's what he says. No, the U.S. government subsidized capitalists who use the U.S. government as their instrument to invest in China and then lower production costs and sell the same product as a quote-unquote Chinese import at the same price they would if they were local, hollowing out the economy. This has been going on for a very long time, obviously. Chinese government may benefit from it, but they had absolutely nothing to do with it. The U.S. government and corporate America has been subsidizing this and covering it up for decades. But the 1990s saw the collapse of not only any kind of nationalism, but now the Western finance, Western created socialist system of the USSR. This is another error of Dugin that the U.S. was ever anti-Soviet. I've been talking about that for years now, and I have. You can go elsewhere to find the information on that I've done. But in the 90s was this very brief period where the American empire was more or less unchallenged. I was the very first one in 1997 for the very first time saying that Russia will be the locus of anti-imperial, not just ideology, but physical force as well. And I was laughed at because this was, Russia had just defaulted on its loans and was a third world country by that point. But the nationalist movement in the 1990s was what? Iran, the national Bolshevism of North Korea and to some extent Cuba, Chavez in Venezuela, a handful of other places. And taken together, even these states were not particularly dangerous and didn't threaten the Americans in any way. And in fact, they were useful for the ruling class to create a boogeyman that they could use to justify military spending and the whole militarization of society. But again, I was the first one to say that this is going to come to an end with the rise of Vladimir Putin. And of course, the regime is very much aware of this, that not only did he show that his form of national, kind of Eurasianist-style civilizational nationalism could work, it could bring a third world country, one that was consigned to oblivion, to first world status in just a few years. That's a feat that very few people can claim to have presided over. And Russia very rapidly rebuilt itself with very little support, actually no support from the outside world, endless condemnation from the outside world, and began not just physically but intellectually and ideologically to challenge the West, meaning liberalism. And the same thing goes for China. That had been going on for a bit longer, but the rise of China also was an ideological, in their case, a national socialist challenge to the West. As I've spoken of many times, the idea of socialism with Chinese characteristics is their version of national socialism in some form or another. And Russia became the seventh largest economy in the world, which, as I've, again, as you all know, is only a tiny portion of its GDP is oil-based. That's another just American myth. China became probably the largest economy in the world. And I say that only because the U.S. doesn't actually make things. China does. So that by itself, I mean, financial instruments are an economic growth, but they're counted as economic growth. So then you have those two powers building alliances with places like Iran and Belarus, which culminated in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Again, I'm the only one who, at least on our side, has been talking about this to any great extent. A few have taken from me on that respect, but it's something that is not in the day-to-day vocabulary even of some of our people. Nationalism was reborn. And the intellectual foundation in America and elsewhere was building for a long time, and especially in Russia, where the advent of buccaneer capitalism completely delegitimized liberalism for all future Russian thinkers. And clearly, Russia and China's success was not done under a liberal system. Although Russia had free elections, it was certainly not not a liberal regime, and it had no foundation for a liberal regime. China certainly was not. Now, all of a sudden, the ideological smugness and arrogance of the West and their professors was collapsing. And as many predicted, I was among them, that the campus speech codes and the banning of everything, the burning of books, was going to continue to develop. Because they don't know how to deal with opposition. They don't hear it very much. They understand us only by caricature. So, as Dugin would say, the foundation for a multipolar world came into existence. Putin's Russia and China now, of course, are allied. They've been allied for a long time. And they have allies all over the place. In Africa, in Latin America. And they tend to be doing much better than the West, which now economically is in terminal decline. And this is long before there was any COVID nonsense. But it's also easy to exaggerate, as Dugin tends to do. Russia and China do have liberal aspects of their societies. The very fact that you have any Western influence at all, you're going to have it. You do have strong nationalist tendencies in the West that are growing stronger by the day, which is one of the reasons that the mass banning and destruction by all kinds of measures of all of our organizations in Europe and America had to happen. Liberalism is totalitarian in the sense that it doesn't permit any deviation from itself. Liberalism only accepts opposition if it's in fact a faction of liberalism. It doesn't understand anything else. But it wasn't merely the rise of these states, but it was the collapse of the United States. The fact that the U.S. reached levels of debt, both private and public, that were beyond ever being repaid. Faith in the dollar slowly collapsed. Gold continued to rise. And the introduction of the Great Depression in America was 2008, with the when the regime simply pushed too far and then used the taxpayer to bail itself out, and no one said a word at the time. And this is what paved the way for 2016. Again, this is mostly rhetoric. It isn't reality. Nevertheless, it is still remarkable. Even in the Middle East, the movement, the rise of the Shia movement, of Hamas, part of Syria, Iran, Iraq, parts of Lebanon, West Bank and the Gaza Strip, where Hamas has done very well. Hezbollah is very well armed. They defeated the Israelis in 2000, a few years after that, destroying the South Lebanon army. They're genuinely popular. They receive Russian money. They receive some Chinese investment. And Turkey's conflict with the U.S. and NATO, which I spoke about on my Thursday show, The Daily Nationalist with Sven, many, many times over, and some of their defense purchases going to the Chinese. I believe that the so-called coup a few years ago and the threat of a color revolution brought him back. And of course, he was very important with the creation of the American invented ISIS threat, which is one of the proxy forces that the U.S. relies on because it simply doesn't have the money or the manpower to project force anymore, or even the legitimacy. It doesn't have, it has nothing except force and threats. That's all liberalism ever has been. Wherever liberalism is imposed, it's imposed by force. From the Glorious Revolution in Britain to the French Revolution to the White Revolution in Russia, Sun Yat-sen in China. I mean, everywhere it's gone, it has to be done by force and violence. And once they take over, or the U.S. in the 1960s, through the Supreme Court and the mobs then, it will attempt to destroy all opposition, which it always does. So that's the context here. And Sam Francis, who was one of my favorite writers from years ago, spoke about middle American radicals. Now, I think this is a bit of an exaggeration. Most middle Americans are scared and fairly ignorant and are not willing to fight then or now. But he did talk about a very strong current, whether he called it paleo-conservative or paleo-nationalist, whatever you want to call it, even paleo-libertarian in some cases, the Lou Rockwell types, who I admire in many ways. Finally had a leader, finally had someone to rally around. Pat Buchanan, well, I was a big part of his campaign in New Hampshire and Iowa. The media then eventually just shut him up. Trump was far more difficult to control. And the so-called middle American radicals that that Sam Francis talked about, Joe Sobran to a lesser extent, the people who used to subscribe to the spotlight and your patriot right wingers. They're not conservatives in the normal sense, but they've gone beyond that. These are some of the people who coalesced around Donald Trump. And the regime was well aware of this group, solidifying prior to 2016 by the mass banning and mass deplatforming of anything that opposed itself. But by 2016, globalism had failed absolutely miserably. The Western powers were almost completely broke. The U.S. military was broken and in defeat. And non-liberal powers were rising and doing extremely well, not only economically, but socially. But the rise of Trump was not something that anyone expected. They didn't expect him to run for president. He was not a very political guy before then. They didn't expect him to really get the nomination. They certainly didn't expect him to win. And once he did, and the whole concept of draining the swamp sent these people into, as we all know, literal and actual hysterics. And I also don't want to underestimate the fact that one of Trump's priority, and it's something that he does deserve praise for, is the mass roundup of pedophiles. I think the number now is about 9,000 total, with vehement condemnations from the press. Huge number of university professors, as I well knew, local, you know, congressmen and local politicians and elites of all types were being rounded up in huge numbers. The left openly supported these people and attempted to normalize the transgender nonsense and pedophilia, at least so long as the elites were doing it. Lower level people, you know, they could be condemned and they'll be sent to prison. But people more powerful than they are, they were defended. I always use the example of, you know, Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin had a 14-year-old girl, at least one, in his hotel room on tour. Rolling Stone said how funny that was. Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, something very similar. And these guys have been doing it for a long time. The news media knows about this, and not only doesn't have any problem with it, but even kind of romanticizes it. So, as this rejection of the system began to consolidate, the most vicious name-calling campaign, smear campaign, the press just began making up stories. The Saturday Night Live debacle, you know, Saturday Night Live has always been one of my favorite shows ever since I was a kid. And it's been a political show, but they're actually they've been pretty even-handed over the decades, except now. No one's a bigger SNL fan than I am, but it simply isn't funny. The political, there's a few exceptions to that. But the political stuff isn't meant to be funny. It's meant to actually preach and to say, this is what you have to do, because this is what liberals do. And liberalism is the same thing as being cultured, although they reject the whole idea of culture. And of course, as far as the nationalist movement is concerned, whether it be at Charlottesville with 2,000 men on the ground, Pikeville and these other places where we were outnumbering the left in every respect, the regime went into extreme panic mode. Now, I've said for a while that the American presidency is mystified beyond belief. And this is an area in Dugin's work that he makes a terrible mistake. He believes that the outcome of the election will dictate the so-called architecture of the New World Order, or the world order in general, the global geopolitical strategy of the U.S. The fate of NATO, in fact, is all based on this, the dominant ideology and the polarization of the parties. Dugin is wrong in this regard because the president simply doesn't have that much power. He doesn't have that much power, and Donald Trump and his administration hasn't been in any respect unified or even coherent in this so-called America First idea. Donald Trump has said that he will not withdraw America's leadership, so-called leadership, from the globe, which of course, you know, the U.S. has no right to even remotely consider that role. That's not in the powers of the presidency, God knows. The architecture of the world order does not depend on the American presidency. In fact, the changes that occur had nothing to do with politicians at all. Even the geopolitical strategy of the U.S., neither Trump or Biden is really aware enough of what a geopolitical strategy even is. This will be done by corporations and banks and career diplomats and people in the bureaucracy, institutions like, you know, the IMF. That's the geopolitical strategy of the United States. It has nothing to do with politicians. Presidents simply don't have that power. And God knows the fate of NATO has nothing to do with the American presidency. Although one positive thing that Trump attempted to do, I mean, he certainly is against its dissolution, and in fact, Trump's been in favor of its extension in Eastern Europe. He just wants the Western powers to slightly increase the amount of money they spend on it. So where Dugin's getting this, you know, he's going to dissolve NATO, is just an exaggeration. And at the same time, he doesn't seem to know Biden very well either. I remember vaguely the 1988 campaign where Biden was humiliated. The stories he told, the ridiculous plagiarism and all this, he's just simply an ignoramus. He doesn't have principles. The man has gone back and forth on every issue you can imagine because he's a politician. This is what they do. Having principles is just one more prop that a politician can have. But you know, you think of people like Bob Dole, you know, and I think Bob Dole's a Republican, Biden. They're politicians in the worst sense, in that they don't stand for anything. They specialize in backdoor deals. That's really who they are. They're about, you know, constituencies. They're about, the mechanics of legislation having nothing to do with principles. If you follow any particular law, and this is actually pretty hard to do, as I had to do even in school, from its inception to its signature by the president, and you follow the law through all the subcommittee hearings with the main committee, then the subcommittees, then back to the main committee again, then the conference committee and everything else, you'll see that ideology is rarely even brought up and party lines have no basis, have no relevance. You did something like the Clean Air Act of, you know, back in 92. Party membership and ideology was completely irrelevant as far as the horse trading and that was concerned. It was, you know, bringing investment into the district was the only thing that mattered, at least in the House. So Dugin, you know, has a fundamental misunderstanding of American politics. And he falls into this error that almost all Americans do of importing this mystifying, almost blasphemous divinity onto the office of president. And I spoke about this several times the last few weeks. The absurdity, the ignorance that, you know, the American president seems to have this kind of power. The economy is his fault. The entire fate, and Dugin is saying here, the entire fate of the world order and world economics and world everything is based on the November 2020 election. Now, for someone as intelligent as Dugin, this was an incredibly stupid statement. He doesn't have that power. I don't care what the agenda is. The U.S. government doesn't have even that influence. They don't have the money. So this is not an issue here. But the American press has been feeding that idea because not only are they interested, of course, in destroying Trump, but in creating a sensational situation where people then are glued to the TV or glued to the newspaper. And so things like, you know, immigration, certain most foreign policy, healthcare, this kind of thing will not be significant factors. The things that he listed here that apparently presidents have complete and total power over is really what's going to matter. The U.S. is divided largely because of mass immigration and because the major media has created it that way. There's nothing in politics that the media hasn't created directly. It is far more sensational to talk about riots than to talk about cooperation. Many of us have already noted that if you take, say, even the National Socialist idea, take out any labels or any names and just give the ideas just abstractly, you'll see a massive consensus pretty fast among the people you're talking to. The minute you say, oh no, this is the NS idea, all of a sudden it's contemptible. Most Americans simply don't have principles. They don't understand principles. That's for small minorities. Ideologies are, you know, like football teams. You root for them like you root for the Steelers. People have been following the election returns, you know, like they're watching the Super Bowl. But that's what politics is. It's part of the entertainment complex. Politics, in that sense, it is not how power operates. The media entertainment complex stuff is not politics at all. It's strictly entertainment. Now, Dugin's argument then from that, and it's interesting, but it, I think it's ultimately false. He takes the idea of the land and sea powers, which most of you already recognize, the Eurasianist idea, the so-called geopolitical idea, although that term is much older, and then applies it to the U.S. Now, we know that the so-called sea commerce civilization, is associated, always has been, with, you know, progress and liberalism and technology in general. The land-based is based on traditionalism and identity and stability. The former is based on deceit and money and alchemy. The latter is based on tradition and hierarchy and community. They are, to a great extent, polar opposites of one another, and they can't coexist. Now, he wants to claim that, he's going to go so far as to say that that can be applied not just to countries, but to regions within countries. And this is fairly new for him. It's a bit of a departure from his earlier understandings of how this stuff works out. And again, he's incorrect here. Here's basically what he says. The East Coast is democratic stronghold. The big metropolitan areas, the Democrats dominate the area, the East Coast. Central America, Central USA, the Midwest, the agricultural zones, the heartland, as he would call it, completely Republican, certainly. The West Coast, the so-called mega cities and the high-tech sector areas, are Democratic. So this is how he kind of miniaturizes the geopolitical idea and the Eurasianist idea to the U.S. So he then concludes in 2020, the U.S., of course, is not in any way a singular entity, but it has two civilizational zones. The heartland, which includes, you know, the South, and the two coasts. The problem is, when you look at the 2016 returns, the only thing that, if you go county by county or district by district, only a few areas of the big cities, and that alone, did the Democrats win. The overwhelming majority of the East Coast counties went to Donald Trump. You have a small smattering of the color blue, in, you know, LA, in Chicago, and New York City, and Miami. That's really all you have. And everything else is colored in red. So, you know, you're talking about coastal zones is far from a Democratic stronghold. It's only a few cities, and even in certain parts of those few cities. But because of their massive population, even with the Electoral College, they control how things go. The non-white population, and of course, the Jewish element, is what pushes them to the and keeps them to the left. And of course, comes the worst, they have street gangs and Antifa to threaten you into submission. Prior to 2016, Dugin says that the U.S. essentially was one big megacity, which in and of itself is also wrong. But applying the Eurasianist idea within a country is very, very new. I spent a lot of time a few years ago explaining how the eastern and western parts of Ukraine were inaccurately depicted. Ukrainian nationalists were huge in much of eastern Ukraine, and vice versa. It can't be exaggerated. You had certain regions, sometimes very powerful regions, that went one from another. I showed where all the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox in eastern Ukraine were huge. They have hundreds of parishes there. But this is what happens when you over generalize. Part of the problem with kind of civilizational politics, even men who I admire, like Eric Voegelin, when your unit of analysis is something like a civilization, you're going to oversimplify. You can't reduce an entire civilization to a few slogans or even a few volumes. It's way too complicated for that. It's highly questionable. In fact, Dugin's entire argument here is questionable. The general theory, I mean, you know, Dugin gets much deeper than some of the fourth political theory stuff. That's just kind of, you know, the most accessible aspect of what he does. And a lot of you know what that is. I accept that understanding of the world. And it's been around a very long time. I think it's historically and politically sound. But then again, you always have the tendency to exaggeration because you're talking about summarizing huge areas of the world under a few ideological slogans. And the most you could say is that the tendency of these places is to produce elites that then develop these ideologies. So the errors here so far is, and again, Dugin is hardly alone in this respect, the hyper hysterical reaction of the left to Donald Trump was completely media invented. In the 2016 campaign, Trump didn't say very much on our side. If you went to his campaign website, it was extremely moderate. He was a nationalist mostly in rhetoric, which was enough in many cases. Not being a politician, he didn't really know how to express himself in that very corrupt way. He just shot from the hip, which is something that's always been impressive. Being self-financing, he did whatever the heck he wanted. But in general, he does accept the neoliberal agenda, if from inertia, if nothing else. But even if he didn't, that's irrelevant. Presidents simply don't have the power to remake foreign policy entirely. They simply can't do that. They have so many power centers in the bureaucracy and the legislature and everything else, the banking establishment that seems to run everything. They're the ones who have tremendous influence over politicians. They simply have no power to, regardless of his agenda. He doesn't have the right, no president has a right to have a tax agenda or a healthcare agenda. That's not up to him. Foreign policy is a strong area for presidents, but even that's very limited. This has to be done with the consent of the Senate, which is often the foreign policy body, but unlike the House. And treaties have to go through the Senate, etc. And the war declaring ability in the legislature, of course. And even there, the actually day-to-day operational command is not the president's to have. It goes to actual military men. And as always, the media is the size what's good and what's bad in this respect. So, it's incredibly, wildly an exaggeration to talk about Donald Trump really as having firm principles at all. He does what he has to do because he's being forced into it. He hasn't been able to effectively govern because of the constant media disinformation and attack and utter absolute dehumanization, not only of him but everyone around him. And it became frightening to even be associated with him. Which is, of course, the whole point. As I've been talking now here, it's 4:15 a.m. I haven't checked to see what's going on. The left has busted people into Washington, D.C. I want you to watch for the idea that Trump supporters are going to allegedly going to be there. The media needs to create the illusion that both sides are at fault here. Especially the Trump people who apparently riot all the time. They need to give that illusion. I strongly doubt Trump has anybody there. I don't think they're not going to do this, but most of those guys will not take that chance. They're not really fighters. They're not going to go up against Antifa or Black Lives Matter or any of the other, well, black nationalist groups, actually, those who have black members. Black Lives Matter is completely Jewish and female. White women dominate all these groups. But they're actual black nationalist groups that I have the feeling don't want nothing to, don't want anything to do with Black Lives Matter. And they have a tendency to fight with Antifa a lot of the time anyway. But the last thing you're going to see is any of our people there. They'll be dressed up in Trump outfits and things to make it look like there's a Trump presence there. And the point is for the media to say that this has been created by Trump and his supporters. So the entire thing is completely fraudulent. There's a lot of pictures that have been photoshopped and manipulated. You know, when the brain is presented with a picture, you tend to start looking for patterns. You fill in the blanks, and the media's description will fill it in for you. And it's very hard to break out of that. Psychological warfare, especially in times of great stress right now, is very, very easy to pull off. And you know, I've seen, you know, Photoshop pictures in New York Times and elsewhere of our people and Trump, completely manipulated in every way to make him appear like he's doing something. So anyway, that's where it stands right now. I don't know when these ridiculous elections are ever going to be decided, but we do know that no matter what happens, whether Trump's elected or not, it doesn't matter. By any standard, the election was completely illegitimate and fraudulent, and the violence and censorship that the left, and exclusively the left, and corporate America has imposed on this. And again, if it were done in the third world, the U.S. would condemn it and threaten to invade. The entire system is fraudulent. The entire system doesn't have a shred of legitimacy. And no matter what happens, whether Trump's elected or not, there's absolutely no reason to be optimistic. Anyway, in the meantime, I appreciate your support. I appreciate your financial donations. As I've said, I've been kicked off Facebook now permanently. I've tried to make a couple of other accounts. They've all been kicked off immediately. So I guess I'm off to Gab. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. You know, I was on Facebook since 2006. I had students put me on there. I had 2,000 friends or something, you know, built up for a long period of time. It just shows you that these people, my posts over the last few months have been pretty tame. A lot of personal stuff I haven't really been talking about, you know, politics, a few things with Kyle Rittenhouse, but that was a few months, that was when that first happened. So they're simply, you know, rounding up everyone that even remotely challenges the system and makes it impossible for them to communicate. But people like me need your financial support. So many of you have come forward and assisted me and more than anything else, that's what keeps me going, both financially and emotionally. I really appreciate it. I thank you. And I thank Savannah at Radio Albion and everyone who's assisted me. And I appreciate you all listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.